I think everyone is present. So this is the case of Gunther versus Walnut Grove Hillside Condo, Regime Number 3, Inc. And we will begin this morning by introductions of members of the court. I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now by seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning, William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik.
And John Friedenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Counsel, Mr. Dorward, are you present this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. And Mr. Belcastro, are you present this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are muted.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you hear me?
Now we can, yes. Welcome to WebEx.
Thank you.
Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, if I may.
You certainly may do that. Any other questions?
No, Your Honor.
Let us proceed then, Mr. Dorward. Again, good morning, and you may proceed.
Good morning, and thank you. May it please the court, Tom Dorward on behalf of appellant. The main question before the court is whether the Fair Housing Act was violated. And I'll walk you through the steps that are part of the process here in making a reasonable accommodation request under the Fair Housing Act. The person asking for the reasonable accommodation has to show a disability, show that they notified the housing provider of the disability, and then make a reasonable accommodation request, and that the accommodation request was denied. And under the reasonable accommodation request, it is reasonable if it's necessary and reasonable prima facie on its face and presumably. There was a disability in this case, and there was clear error, pure error by the district court and by the housing provider, as the disability was not disputed. Opposing counsel in her motion for directed verdict stated, there's no dispute that Natalie Gunther has a disability. It was not a disputed issue. That's the first-
Counsel, what did the district court find in regard to the issue of handicap or disability?
The district court found that that we did not meet our burden of proving disability. We argue that it wasn't a disputed issue, and we also argue that we did prove it. In Exhibit 2, there was a doctor's note stating that she suffers from major depressive disorder and anxiety, which are both listed under the definition of disability under HUD guidelines and under the Fair Housing Act. We had a doctor's note and testimony from Natalie and her mother, Christine Gunther, who is the appellant. So that is by definition and by the doctor's note and exhibit a disability. Secondly, the reasonable accommodation request was necessary. Natalie testified that the fence, which is her request.
What is this court's standard of review? How much deference do we give to the district court's determination of disability?
Well, the court makes the determination of disability, and this court reviews it de novo. We believe that the court incorrectly applied the law, incorrectly looked at disability, and made a determination where there was no dispute as to it. So opposing party didn't present an expert witness, didn't present a psychologist or a doctor to dispute the fact that there was a disability. There was a doctor's note and exhibit. It was testified to that she had hospitalizations. And so I'll get to the necessity issue. On the defense was necessary because she has testified that her previous dog died. Her previous dog died, and she has a mental health setback because of this. So the doctor's note and her alleviation of symptoms due to the fence have a nexus to the reasonable accommodation. There's an Oregon case, Mayorga, that we cited in our brief, which is the exact same facts pattern. And that case cited that the fence is part and parcel of the animal assistance. That case allowed that it was necessary and it was reasonable, prima facie and on its face, and then the burden should have shifted to opposing party to show that it was unreasonable. And there are three ways that it's unreasonable. It's a direct...
I will back up to necessity real quick.
Sure.
In the record, it appears that the daughter does not reside in that household the majority of the time of the year. She does not have the animal with her when she is not residing in the house. Does that play a part in the court's determination of necessity?
I don't believe that factored into the court's analysis in the order. The court simply said that she takes the dog on walks and goes out and about. Our focus is on the analysis that should have been undertaken, whether it was reasonable and necessary. And if it's prima facie reasonable and necessary by showing that it alleviates her symptoms because she wouldn't worry about the dog being killed, then it is necessary. So
what did we say in Wilkinson about necessity means?
Right.
In this exact context.
Well, I think the Wilkinson case can be distinguished from this case because the Wilkinson case was a city ordinance case with a pit bull. And in that case, the owner had had a different dog for 2 years and had had a chance to make a request prior to the ordinance going into effect. He didn't take advantage of that. He also had he had a dog for 2 years and was fine, and then had this pit bull. And so they said, well, it's not necessary because he could have made the request before and he had this previous dog. In this case, it's necessary because the previous dog died. So we need
in that counsel, in that case, did we say necessity equates to essential?
It's essential or has a nexus to the reasonable accommodation, and we argue that
and in this case, did the appellees provide alternatives to the fencing of the property?
Well, they didn't. This is where the violation of the act occurred. The process was in exhibits 13, 14, and 15. There were emails sent making the request. There was an immediate no. There was no analysis. There was no analysis of necessity. There was no verification of her doctor or whether there was a necessity if it alleviated symptoms. That is the process that needs to be undertaken in the Fair Housing Act, instead of just saying no immediately. And that's where the violation occurred. These proposals didn't come in until after the lawsuit, until a demand letter had been sent and then a lawsuit had been filed. And these proposals are irrelevant because they have to first show that it's unreasonable and then go to the proposals. And
well, isn't your client asking to fence in a property that she doesn't own, that it's common property owned by the condominium regime as a whole?
Right. So the real issue we're focused on is whether the fenced in area would fundamentally alter the nature of the condo regime. It wouldn't, because she borders on another neighbor, Carol Bolton, who testified that is in an enclosed property. And Warwick, the president of the HOA, testified that still is a common area. It's people can open the gate and go in and out. In this, there are fences on three sides and half fence on this side. We just want to enclose it off. So
well, if people can go in and out of the enclosed common areas, what would prevent somebody from taking their dog into that enclosed common area and cause injury to the appellant's dog?
They could do that, but at least they would be present. If a fence were there, at least that would protect from a dog that's stray or their pit bull. There was testimony that there are pit bulls very close by, and if they escape and get into the area without the fence, then that could be dangerous. So we argue that that it's simply enclosing it off. It would remain a common area. Our client is offered to pay for it. There's no fundamental alteration. There's no financial burden. There's no alteration because mowers could come through the gate. People can come in and out. There are grandfathered in enclosed areas, and that doesn't violate the bylaws. So an exception to bylaws, rules, or policies is the very thing required under the Fair Housing Act. And there are cases, Welsh versus McNeil in DC Court of Appeals we cited, that is the exact situation where there's an exception to bylaws. Doesn't say that's a fundamental alteration. And they have to prove unreasonableness of this before they can get to these other proposals. There's also case law that states that the person making the request is best situated to know what the accommodation is. If Natalie testifies she still has anxiety and worry and distress because there's not a fence, then she is best situated to make the request that this fence helps alleviate her symptoms rather than a pole with a tether or other proposals that came in after this was made and after it was rejected prematurely.
If she lives there or not at any point in time in the future, because it would, that fence reduces her stress, so she could never return to that address, but it causes her stress, so they need to have the fence.
So this is where I would say that this court, we would be going outside of the fact pattern before the district court. The testimony is that she, pre-COVID, she was there 3 or 4 nights a week. It's still her permanent residence. She simply studies in Lincoln. She still has a room there. She still does spend several nights a week there. The testimony doesn't have anything about her never going back there. So we wouldn't even go there.
Set my question as a hypothetical.
Accept
my question as a hypothetical then. If she was to never return there, but she has stress because she's worried about her dog, would that fence still need to go up?
It's possible, and we would argue that. I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, but I'll still respond. I would say that there is case law that part-time residents can still make reasonable accommodation requests. Do I have 1 minute for rebuttal, or am I still on the clock? I'm paying attention to the. Anyway, I'll rebut.
The clock keeps running, so when yellow comes up, that's your sign that you're getting into rebuttal time. You get 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
No.
Thank you.
Okay. We will go to Mr. Belcastro. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. At trial, the District Court of Douglas County correctly concluded that 1, appellant failed to carry her burden to prove that appellant or someone residing in appellant's dwelling handicapped within the meaning of the Nebraska and Federal Fair Housing Act, and that 2, appellant had failed to carry her burden to prove that her requested accommodation was reasonable and necessary to the achievement of equal housing opportunities for appellant or her daughter. Accordingly, we pray that this court affirm the trial court's dismissal of appellant's complaint and award Walnut Grove attorney's fees for its defense of this appeal. At the outset, it should be noted that Walnut Grove has never sought to prohibit appellant or her daughter Natalie from having an emotional support animal. Walnut Grove simply seeks to enforce the bylaws that every resident, including appellant, agreed to when they moved into the condo association. What appellant seeks here today is a privilege that no one else in the condominium regime has, the privilege to erect a fence through property that she does not own. Appellant is not seeking equal treatment here, but preferential treatment. Testimony from appellant's neighbors at trial demonstrates that Walnut Grove's residents do not want their neighbors, including appellant, to divide the general common area with fencing. Additionally, appellant admitted at trial and again admits today that even if the area behind her condo were fenced off, the enclosed land would still constitute a general common element of the condominium regime. As such, any other member of the regime would have an equal right to let their own dogs run around in this hypothetical fenced-in area, whether appellant's dogs are back there or not. Thus, it is unclear how appellant's requested accommodation would remedy her alleged concerns in the first place. In any case, as appellant has failed to carry her burden on any of the necessary elements of her claim, this court should affirm the trial court's decision. On the first issue, the trial court correctly concluded that appellant had failed to carry her burden to demonstrate that Natalie is handicapped within the meaning of the Fair Housing Act. As such, this court should affirm the trial court's decision. It should be noted that appellant's suggestion that Natalie lives in appellant's household is a dubious one. And indeed, appellant misconstrues the record. Natalie does not stay at the house 3 to 4 nights a week, even pre-COVID. It was on weekends only. Natalie even testified at trial that despite having a bedroom in appellant's condo, she lived the majority of her time with her friends in Lincoln, where her roommate actually has a dog. Natalie,
Counsel, on the issue of handicap or disability, did the appellees contest that issue at the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. I understand that there's a contention that trial counsel conceded the handicap issue, and that's not true.
Not trial counsel. Trial counsel said there wasn't a handicap. Did appellees concede that issue?
No, that's not true, Your Honor. The exact quote that I believe is being referred to from trial is, nobody has denied that she has a disability. That's the quote from the appellees at trial. In making that statement, Appley's trial counsel was simply referring to the fact that no one had disputed that Natalie had been diagnosed with depression and anxiety disorders as a factual matter. Trial counsel was not conceding that Natalie is legally handicapped within the meaning of the Fair Housing Act. This is evident by the fact that trial counsel did not even use the word handicap when discussing Natalie's condition. If Appley was going to concede an essential element of the plaintiff's case, she would have used the proper terminology that's used in the Fair Housing Act. For the sake of clarity, Walnut Grove does not dispute that Natalie has depression and anxiety as a factual matter. However, Walnut Grove does not agree that simply being diagnosed with depression and anxiety amounts ipso facto to a legal handicap within the meaning of the Fair Housing Act. Under the Fair Housing Act, a handicap is defined as a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more of a person's major life activity. At trial, appellant offered evidence that Natalie has been diagnosed with depression and anxiety, however, failed to offer sufficient evidence that, or in order to support a finding that Natalie's anxiety and depression substantially limited one or more of her major life activities. That's the standard, and it wasn't met in this case. Natalie testified that she was neither receiving treatment nor taking medication for either of her disorders at the time of trial. Additionally, despite living with her friends and their dog in Lincoln, attending college as a full-time student, working part-time, living the majority of her year without the company of her dog, Natalie was still able to commute back and forth to Omaha nearly every week to visit her mother and the dog. Furthermore, Natalie testified at trial that when she does come to Omaha to visit her mother, she's able to freely take the dogs for walks and to play with them both inside and outside the condo. As such, the trial court was correct in concluding that appellant had failed to show that Natalie's anxiety and depression disorders substantially limit one or more of Natalie's major life activities. In any case, it should be noted that it was having a dog, not having a fence, that Natalie's physician recommended for Natalie's disorders. On this point, appellant does not dispute that Walnut Grove has never prohibited nor attempted to prohibit Natalie or appellant from owning dogs at appellant's condo. Accordingly, as appellant has failed to carry her burden to demonstrate that someone residing with her is handicapped within the meaning of the Fair Housing Act, this court should affirm the trial court's decision. Now, on the second issue, even assuming for the sake of argument that Natalie's anxiety and depression disorders do in fact constitute handicaps within the meaning of the Fair Housing Act, the defense that appellant is requesting is neither reasonable nor necessary under the Fair Housing Act. Appellant acknowledges that she bears at least the initial burden of demonstrating the existence of a handicap, that the requested accommodation is necessary, and that the requested accommodation is reasonable on its face. However, appellant argues that once she's made out her prima facie case, the burden switches to Walnut Grove to demonstrate that the requested accommodation is unreasonable. This argument finds no support whatsoever in the controlling case law, and furthermore flies directly in the face of this court's opinion in Wilkson, where this court stated, quote, "The ultimate burden to prove both the reasonableness and the necessity of a requested accommodation remains always with the plaintiffs asserting a reasonable accommodation claim under the Fair Housing Act," close quote. None of the cases that appellant cites displace this court's opinion in Wilkson as controlling on the question of appellant's burden of proof. Accordingly, this court should affirm the trial court's dismissal of appellant's complaint for her failure to carry that burden.
Now, counsel, how is the fencing not necessary for having an emotional support dog?
Well, it's not necessary because, as this court observed in Wilkerson, the word necessary implies more than something merely helpful or conducive. It suggests instead something indispensable, essential, something that cannot be done without. When gauging the necessity of a requested accommodation, courts have to require or have to inquire into whether available alternatives have been offered, which also satisfy the Fair Housing Act's goal of providing equal housing opportunities to handicapped individuals. In the present case, Walnut Grove fulfilled its obligations under the Fair Housing Act because Walnut Grove provided appellant with several reasonable alternative accommodations to her desired fence, including an invisible fence, a privacy fence around her patio, the tethering of her dogs to a fixed point outside, which all other Walnut Grove residents do, or continuing to use the fenced-in portion behind Ms. Bolton's unit as she has been for 2 years already. All of these
opposing counsel seem to suggest that these alternatives were offered too late, maybe after a demand letter or after the lawsuit was filed. Factually, would you like to respond to that? And does that matter legally?
factually, I don't believe that's accurate, Your Honor. I can double check the record. I'd be happy to submit supplemental briefing if that would be helpful to the court, but I don't believe that's factually accurate. As a legal matter, it doesn't make any difference. There's no controlling case law that suggests that the timing is in any way relevant, whether it happens before a demand letter or after a demand letter, or even after the case has been initiated. The point is, she's seeking a reasonable accommodation under the Fair Housing Act, and she's been offered several reasonable alternatives that satisfy all of the criteria that she has set forth for her accommodation. Other owners have dogs in Walnut Grove neighborhood, and none of them are entitled to this requested accommodation, whether they or someone that lives with them or someone that doesn't live with them has depression or anxiety or anything like that. So all of the accommodations that I previously mentioned, including the invisible fence, the privacy fence, tethering of her dogs, all of these things, they all work to keep appellant's dogs near the condo. And two of them specifically also keep other dogs away from appellant's, to the extent that they even can be, because as appellant has conceded, it's a general common area, and there's no way to preclude other people from coming in or from entering property that everyone owns communally, as this is a condominium regime. As this court recognized in Wilkerson just 2 years ago, nothing in the Fair Housing Act gives an individual the right to their preferred accommodation. Now, in short, appellant has failed to carry her burden to demonstrate that appellant or someone living in appellant's dwelling is handicapped within the meaning of the Fair Housing Acts, and that her requested accommodation was reasonable and necessary to the achievement of equal housing opportunities to appellant or her daughter. For the foregoing—
Counsel, you referenced attorney fees and a request for attorney fees for appellee. Were you awarded attorney fees by the trial court?
No, Your Honor, we were not, but—
And did you cross appeal that issue before us?
I do not believe we did, Your Honor.
So are you asking the court to award you attorney's fees for the trial, or are you asking for attorney's fees upon appellate review?
I see I'm out of time. May I take a brief moment to respond, Your Honor?
Hey.
Yes, we are requesting attorney's fees for both the defense of this appeal and the trial, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
35 seconds, Your Honor.
35 seconds. Now, Mr. Dorwart, I may have confused you on this, so we'll give you 2 minutes.
Ms. Dorwart, you're on mute.
We're asking for it. Thank you, Your Honor. We're asking for attorney fees as well. The disability was proven, and disability and handicap are interchangeable under the Fair Housing Act. Major depressive disorder and anxiety are under the very definition under the HUD guidelines and under the Fair Housing Act of disability. Natalie testified, I believe, that she spent time in the hospital. That limits the life activity. These are lifelong things that she'll have to deal with. Secondly, a fence is necessary if a previous dog had died and gave her a setback. The fence is necessary if she believes it's necessary, and there's no rebuttal testimony about her emotional or her mental health needs.
Counsel, do we have evidence in the record of how the other dog died?
We don't. We know that it was outside of the condo. We know that it was outside. It wasn't inside. It was found outside.
So the death alone is sufficient to create a necessity?
Well,
how the dog died
the necessity is focused on her request. Is the fence necessary to alleviate her symptoms? And it goes along with the dog. So I would point again to the Mayorga case, which was the same fact situation where they said a fence goes along with the dog, just as in Warwick, the president of the HOA admitted that they would make an exception to bylaws to install a ramp for a wheelchair. It's the same situation. The dog is the wheelchair. The ramp is the fence. It goes along with it. We're not requesting the dog. They say, well, we allow her to have the dog. That wasn't the request. The request is for the fence. And I'm not talking about the demand letter and when that was sent. That wasn't what my point I was making. My point was that under the Fair Housing Act, the violation occurred when the answer no was given without following the process, without asking, is it necessary? Do we verify with her doctor? Do we ask questions? Do we do an analysis? Instead, there were emails.
Do you have case law to support that contention?
We do. In the developmental services case that we cited, as well as I believe even in the Eighth Circuit, there are cases, and in the Welsh versus McNeil DC Court of Appeals case, and the Mayorga case, but the developmental services case is the Nebraska case, I believe, and these cases held that you know, once the request is made, they have to engage in a process. They cannot just say flat out no, and that's what they did without looking into the necessity or the reasonableness. Saying no, that was the violation right there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dorwart. That concludes arguments in Gunther versus Walnut Grove Hillside Condo Regime Number 3, Inc. Council, again, thank you very much for participating by WebEx. You are now excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Ryan versus Streck, Inc.